This is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
G'day, you are listening to RTRFM 92.1, The Sound Alternative, and I'd like to acknowledge that we are broadcasting from the unceded lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people, and I'd like to offer my respects to them and their elders past and present. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This is the Indie Media Show, your grassroots journalism from local, national and international protest movements. And before I get down into it, I'd like to thank Jeff and the On The Record crew for another fantastic edition of On The Record, keeping us informed and grooving to some very cool tunes, hearing some good chats. It is a very lovely show. My name is Joni Boyd, and I'll be with you for the next hour covering a range of topics. Today on Indie Media, we will hear from our in-house foreign affairs expert Alex Wisson with our continuing coverage of the Russian war on Ukraine and its broader global effects. And we will also hear some voices from the Trans Day of Visibility rally that happened this Sunday just gone, and a lot of those voices will be speaking about the intersection of trans rights and sex worker rights, as well as the high rates of sexual violence towards trans people in Australian universities, and how we can find hope in the face of ongoing hate campaigns against our trans community. On Saturday, transgender activists and our allies gathered in the Perth Cultural Centre for Trans Day of Visibility, an international day for awareness of trans issues and celebration of trans survival and community. A range of issues came up, including the intersection of sex worker rights and trans rights, the disproportionately high rate of sexual violence towards trans people in Australian universities, and the government's religious discrimination bill, and how it is likely to return, regardless of who takes power in the upcoming federal election. I was down there and captured some of the voices heard at the rally, including WA Greens Senate candidate River Clark, Sid/Cass Pemberton from the Curtin Student Guild, independent candidate for Hasluck Janine Williams, and first up from Decrim WA, this is Lena Van Hale. Oh, apologies. A language warning for... I really need to do a language warning, especially for this first one. So I actually need to quickly reload this. I am so sorry because I have I've made a mistake. Yeah, language warning for these next couple of speeches, especially this first one. Trans people, we get very angry about stuff, as you might imagine. Big language warning for this Trans Day of Visibility rally. This is from Decrim WA, Lena Van Hale.
G'day, my name's Lena Van Hale. I'm here from Decrim WA. We are a collective of sex workers in Perth banded together to talk about the laws here to try and decriminalise the sex industry. Because laws are fucked. In WA, we can do sex work, but it's treated like a fucking hobby. Our pay is not treated like wages. Bosses can take it back from us. Cops can force us to give it back to people. We can get evicted for no reason, just for engaging in our work, because it's not a legal job, right? Even though it's legal for us to do it, but if we take money for it, then we're running a legal business. But it's not a business that we can sign on as a fucking business. And we're in this constant catch-22. Local councils can shut down our businesses. The vast majority of the WA6 industry are people working in underground places like, you know, health studios, massage parlors, not advertising as sex work, right? Because if they're detected, they get kicked out, they've got nowhere to work, and your work becomes so much more fucking dangerous. If you're found with condoms in some of these places, your local council can shut you down. Even though the police can't use those evidence, local council still can. So the laws are fucked. We're trying to change them. We've got better laws in New South Wales. They decriminalised 1996. Northern Territory decriminalised in 2018. Victoria has just promised us to decriminalise by next year. I want people to be really clear that trans rights and sex worker rights are completely inextricably intertwined, right? So many of us, generations of our community, couldn't access employment almost anywhere else but the sex industry. So many of my peers and myself. Our modern sex worker rights movement came out of women's liberation movements, right? And our movement was for all women's work. And there's a number of really amazing famous actions around the world that have spawned our new movement, right? I often say to people that I'm part of the first generation of trans women in this country since colonization, where more than half of us who are out in our 20s can expect to live into our 50s. Because of the fucking scourge of our last pandemic, the HIV pandemic, swept across the world, over 45 million deaths, right? And if you've ever looked around and wondered why there's no trans people in society that are visible within a certain age group, just remember how many of us we fucking lost, how many generations of our community are invisible to us because of how invisible we were to the governments, to the health systems around the world that wouldn't treat us, that wouldn't look for treatments for HIV, that wouldn't educate the population about it. And it's because of our collectives and because of our movements of queer people and sex workers and injecting drug users who banded together, educated each other about HIV, about the health crisis, that so many of us survived till today. And for so long in this country, the average sex worker knew more about HIV than the average doctor. None of us got to grow up in a world where our community had that visibility for the last 50 years. And that is what people are now trying to sweep away from us. Now that we have generations we can all expect to live into our 50s, they want to silence us, they want to take away our medication, they want to shut us out of the education systems, they want to shut us out of legal systems. They will stop at absolutely nothing to find ways to make us invisible again.
Shame.
Shame.
But we are visible now, and we are visible to uplift our most vulnerable, our sister girls, our brother boys, trans people of color, trans sex workers, trans young people, trans people with disability. Because if our movements can't protect our most marginalized and our most vulnerable, if our people can't protect our vulnerable, we all get swept away. Our government don't just make it legal to discriminate against me, they make it legal to discriminate against everyone. And that's what visibility means. As trans people, we don't get to settle for halves. What does half a medical system get us? What does half of a respect get us? What does half of the law get sex workers like we have in WA? And what the fuck good does half visible do for us? Are we half alive? Are we half dead? So, and there's a reason for this, right? They try and keep us out of all these systems. Trans people in this country and in many other countries, we are seen as this tool, right, by the far right, by the conservative religious groups. We are seen as this weak point in a chain to attack all visibility, to attack all of our communities, to attack all progressives, because they think that we are weak. We are not weak. You are not weak. We are not invisible. In a fight between trans people and the backwards conservatives in this country, we are not the piss weaklings. So to all trans people, do not believe those lies. You are not like that. Do not believe the lie that you are weak. Do not believe what you were sold, that you're supposed to be terminally weak, helpless. Whatever you do, there's a million ways that you can work, that you can change things for the better, that you can help our communities, but do not believe their bullshit propaganda. They want everyone to believe we're weak so that we will go back to being invisible. But that time is past. Thank you very much.
just when all of this religious discrimination bill stuff started, I sat there and said, what are people trying to do this for people like me for? Where all I've done is try to help people. There's actually a very simple reason where all of this comes from. And it's because there are basically two styles of leadership. There are people who lift and support, and there are people who lead by domination and segregation. And that's what we've actually got now, is we have people who dominate, and they need people to be broken down into small minorities. The biggest danger for them are people who actually can pull themselves out and be strong. And that's what the transgender community are. We are people who have no choice. Just to stay alive, we have to fight ourselves and go forward and become and be strong. And that is a massive danger to people who work like that. Not only that, but we're one of the few groups that actually represents everybody. Transgender people are women, they're men, they're disabled, they're young, they're old, they're rich, they're poor, they're black, they're white, they're indigenous, they're immigrants, they're refugees. So we are a community that when we stand up and when we are strong, we're actually showing every community that you can do the same thing. And that's why we are singled out. Because if we stand up, everybody stands up.
Hi everyone, my name's Kat Sid. My pronouns are she, they. I'm the queer officer at the Curtin Student Guild. Before I start, I just want to say this is kind of an angry speech. A content warning for mentions of sexual harassment, transphobia, poverty, and the terrible government new systems that trans people have to experience every single day. Before I start my speech, I'd like to acknowledge that this is the land of the Wadjuk Noongar people and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. This land was stolen and never ceded. It was and always will be Aboriginal land. I represent the queer community at the biggest university in WA. My job is hard, but insanely rewarding. Being able to give back to the community is such a joy, even when I pour more hours into the role than I probably should. The people in the community are my friends and my family. So when I see how bad they are hurting because the university and or the government is not supporting them enough, I get angry. Trans people can have it hard at university, especially at Curtin. They may be able to have classes where they are safe and validated, full of queers or allies, but what about the ones where they are shunned and discriminated against just for trying to be who they are? They may be able to update their names in the Curtin system to their preferred ones, but what about when all the systems don't talk to each other and they get repeatedly deadnamed in emails and in class? They may receive assurances from the university that their safety and comfort is a priority to them, but what about when you remove all traces of a transpositive campaign that was put up all over campus? The Curtin Guild had a campaign running called We All Need to Pee, which were stickers we put up in bathrooms telling people to respect any trans or gender diverse people they saw in them. The title of the campaign said, We All Need to Pee. For the year that it was actively in operation, stickers were defaced. When they were, the Guild replaced them as soon as they could so we could show the transphobes who tried to scratch them out that this campaign would not go away. The campaign was put on hold when Properties, a division of the university, decided to take all the stickers down.
Shame.
It was costing them too much to repair the damage done by the transphobic graffiti. One of the reasons they gave behind the removal is that stickers shouldn't be put up in the bathrooms, especially when the ones we put up were purposely made hard to remove. That was done so transphobes could not remove them easily. And our stickers were the only ones they chose to remove. There have been stickers up in the bathrooms for years they haven't bothered to try to scrape away because they didn't draw their attention. And the fact that Properties has not met with me or Dax, the previous QO, or anyone from the Guild face-to-face and only communicated reluctantly and slowly through emails show that they are scared of what we have to say to them, that we are in the right. Maybe, Curtin, you should prioritise the safety and well-being of your trans students over graffiti done by transphobes.
Maybe you should use some of the $113 million in surplus you made last year to protect one of the most vulnerable and discriminated against minorities in our society. The results of the National Student Safety Survey came out last week. This was a survey completed by students last year about their experiences of sexual violence on campus. And guess what the results showed? In the last 12 months, 1 in 5 trans and gender diverse students at Curtin were sexually harassed. That is too fucking many. Anything more than zero is too fucking many. Maybe if you hadn't pulled the plug on a massive trans positive campaign the Guild had set up, the statistics might be better. Or used any of the millions of dollars you made during this pandemic while trans students barely managed to get by. The statistics are even worse at other WA universities. 1 in 3 trans people sexually harassed at UWA in the last 3 years. The same, 12 months. The same at Murdoch. And now let's look at the stats nationwide. 40% or 2 in 5 non-binary students have been sexually harassed since starting university. For trans students, it is 26% or 1 in 4. And so many didn't report this because they're afraid of not being taken seriously or being discriminated against further in the system that's supposed to protect them. It's fucking abysmal.
Out of the bars and into the streets.
Out of the schools and into the streets.
Out of the schools and into the streets.
Out of the closets and into the streets.
Out of the closets and into the streets.
Out of the bars and into the streets.
Out of the bars and into the streets.
Out of the schools and into the streets.
Out of the closets and into the streets.
Out of the closets and into the streets.
Out of the bars and into the streets.
Out of the bars and into the streets.
Out of the schools and into the streets!
Out of the closets and into the
streets!
Out of the closets and into the
streets!
Happy
Trans Day of Visibility, everyone. Woo! It's great to see you all so visible. Well done, we did it. Look, we've had a shit few months, year, forever, but I want to kind of work that around to some positives because this is, like, our day, or it was on Thursday, and I don't think we should just have to talk about all the shit things that have happened when we can be working towards something better. So, like, Bridges listed off the key things that are really impacting us at the moment, the things that we're working on. And, like, to take, for example, stuff like the religious discrimination bill was horrible and should not have happened. And, like, we expect it from the Liberals, but we kind of expect Labor to at least pretend to have our back. And they didn't even do that. They paid token lip service and then refused to vote against it when it counted.
Shame.
Shame.
In the next parliament, there is a very good chance that this will come up again, and we will see the religious discrimination bill again, no matter who we have in government. And the reality is that we need to keep fighting that, and I know we will. We will keep showing up to fight against these transphobic, homophobic, discriminatory bills, and I can trust on our community to do that. But I think what we've seen with this is that we can go further than that because they didn't succeed with the religious discrimination bill. They gave us a really shit few weeks, but they didn't succeed. They didn't succeed with the supposed Save Women's Sport bill. They haven't succeeded at the City Point school where the principal has since resigned. Even the likes of our wonderful mayor, Basil, has not succeeded in his transphobia because his, I believe the city of Perth was lit up in, the building was lit up in trans colours or something. Like, they keep failing at being transphobic. And what this means is that there's this massive spotlight on the trans community. And sometimes that's really hard because it means that we're constantly under this pressure and we're constantly reading the news. And it's a lot of pressure on us. But it also means that we can take that and we can turn it into something more positive. And I think this is our opportunity to go, actually, no, we're not going to just keep fighting back and standing still. We can go forwards.
Yeah. River Clark, their Greens candidate for the Senate in the upcoming federal election, speaking at Trans Day of Visibility rally last Saturday. You are listening to Indie Media here on RTRFM 92.1, the sound alternative. So earlier today, I chatted to Indie Media's Alex Wisson, continuing our coverage of Russia's war in Ukraine. We chatted about Russia's changing tactics and shifting geopolitical foundations. I started by asking him how things have progressed since the initial invasion back in February.
Well, I think that in recent days we've seen a clear shift in the battlefield strategy of the Russian armed forces. And in a sense, it's come full circle. I believe it was on the second time that I appeared on the show to discuss the crisis in Ukraine. I believe before the war had started and then soon after the war had started, I had said that the main war aims of Russia were to secure a foothold and then later in the campaign to establish actually control and a de facto occupation regime across the southeastern part of Ukraine. And so it's proved to be. And we've also discussed the great shock and awe, if you like, to borrow a phrase from the American imperialist assault on Iraq some 20 years ago. There was an element of shock and awe with the Russians' initial wave, the now famous 40-mile armoured column with artillery, mobile artillery pieces and tanks and armoured personnel carriers and infantry troops, some numbering in some thousands, perhaps even tens of thousands, that was attempting to descend upon and then encircle the capital of Kyiv in the early weeks of this war. Very early on, it became apparent that, well, and this is where the language becomes important, the terminology, was Russia bogged down? Were they tactically outmatched and outwitted by the Ukrainian defenders? As a result,
yeah, there's been a lot of talk. There's been a lot of talk from Western media of a handbrake invasion, or that Russia is losing the war strategically.
Right, yes, and there's been a lot of speculation and commentary in the Western press about the logistical incompetence of the invasion, particularly that force surrounding the capital, that it was lacking supplies, logistical supplies, food, fuel, medicine and so forth. And what I would say on that score, and also with respect to the battlefield picture more generally, and I've said this before and I'll likely say it again, it remains very difficult to ascertain the truth of what is happening on the ground. Now, I think we can, having said that, make some preliminary conclusions that Russia's overall strategy to take the capital, to unseat the Zelensky government, to take it by force, to replace that government with a Moscow-friendly regime, has failed. It has failed. But we then need to take into account the time frame that we're talking about. We're only really some 5 weeks into the invasion. It seems, and I stress, it seems that we're in for the long haul, sad to say. But all of this has to be taken with a caveat, Joni, in terms of our understanding from this far afield as to what is really happening. But I think we can safely conclude their strategy is shifting towards the south and the southeast. We've seen horrific assault on Mariupol. Now, just to explain briefly again the strategic importance of that port city of Mariupol, if Russia controls Mariupol, it creates a contiguous land bridge between the Donetsk and Luhansk, so-called People's Republics, in the right in the very east of the country. And that land corridor now stretches all the way closer to the southwestern part of Ukraine. And crucially, in the past couple of days, there have been explosions in the port city of Odessa. There was an attack on an oil terminal on the outskirts of the city. And so that may be the opening gambit, if you like, of a wider offensive on Odessa. If Russia were to take Odessa, that would cut Ukraine off completely from the Black Sea. It is already not gaining supplies from the Black Sea via the Mediterranean. There are reports of Russia actually mining the Black Sea, and it wants control of Odessa. That will give it control of the whole of the south of Ukraine, cutting Kyiv off from the Black Sea, and thus obviously creating enormous political pressure on the Zelensky regime to come to the negotiating table and make a deal with the Russians, on Russia's terms.
So focusing on capturing those territories in the beginning of the war and then perhaps looking for a regime change further down the line?
Well, that's a very important and very good question, Joni, and I wouldn't profess to know the answer to that.
Of course.
In the world that knows the answer to that, perhaps even including Putin himself, because I think there is a fluidity now to his strategy. Whether you want to describe it as a back down, I think you can see it as a back down from trying to seize the capital to now lesser war aims in the south of the country. Now, it's important to say that doesn't mean that the scale, the intensity of fighting and the intensity of the fighting will subside. I think, unfortunately, the opposite may be the case. And we're seeing that picture emerging with heavy bombardment of those southern cities. And it's worth going into a little bit of detail about the nature of that bombardment. I've mentioned before the indiscriminate nature of Grad rockets, and there was also multiple fired rocket launches from mobile artillery pieces, hyperbaric weapons. There has also been the use of hypersonic weapons, which are advanced weapons that, you know, go beyond the speed of sound and can be launched from Russian naval vessels in the Black Sea, can be launched from Russian forces some 1,000 kilometres or more from the battlefield. So they're actually advancing and mobilising and utilising really quite advanced weaponry within the Russian armed forces. There have been reports of redeployment of actually reserve troops isn't quite the wrong, quite the right term, but troops that were combat ready but were sitting sort of not ready to be mobilised, being moved from other parts of Russia. So they're actually sending in more troops. They're not really downscaling the effort. It's just they're reorienting and shifting where those forces are being used more to the south of the country.
And Russia has plenty more to throw at the Ukrainian defence.
Absolutely, and that's one of the great fears, and that's been one of the great fears all along. And I think we're already seeing some evidence of that, as I say, with the use, for instance, of hypersonic missiles. You know, thankfully, the use of tactical nuclear weapons is not on the cards. But I think one of the things that this entire invasion has shown is that the possibilities, if you like, of what can take place in the modern era are now almost limitless. So I think a lot of us, it's kind of a strange connection to make in a way, but it's a lateral connection to make, drawing that connections between the COVID crisis and the invasion of Ukraine and thinking, well, you know, what could possibly happen next? And I mentioned COVID in that context in terms of the nature of the crises we're facing now in the world, and who knows what's next with this invasion. So, you know, just to briefly look at that wider picture, and I've said this before, this is a tectonic shift in the global in global geopolitics.
Absolutely,
shift in global geopolitics. We've seen already a shift in German foreign policy, UK foreign policy, America openly aggressive in supporting arms to Ukraine. Our own government talking about providing Bushmaster armored vehicles to Ukraine. One of the changes actually is a cultural shift in that war has now become, and I'm sure you've noticed this, and many of our listeners have noticed this, that the really disturbing, almost seamless shift that has taken place in our culture, where suddenly we're accepting war and supporting war. And for instance, the UK foreign minister has been on ITV News, I think it was, openly encouraging virtually British citizens to go to Ukraine to fight. That's something new in our culture, that kind of open embrace of war. Before, you know, we've pretended that we're defending democracy, advancing democracy, but really we don't like war very much. There's almost a frenzied embrace of war. And we've seen that with some of the disgusting sort of anti-Russian bigotry, Russian composers and writers, novelists, artists, many of whom are actually opposed to the war, have no love for Putin, been condemned and censured, their performances being censured throughout Europe and other parts of the world. And that's connected with this kind of war fever that has reached really frenzied proportions. And I think that's something new in our culture and will have a lasting impact.
Yeah, I've heard in the States some rumours of Russian-American business owners being targeted and attacked.
Yeah, there are countless stories of that and of Russian citizens or dual citizens being asked even to perform loyalty tests. There was a UK minister, or UK MP rather, who wrote a tweet since deleted asking Russian Britons to perform a loyalty test to Britain. Now, we've not seen that sort of crass nationalism war fever.
It's a bit old school.
Probably since the Second World War, Joni, and that kind of, let me be clear about it, America, Australia, we've been involved in multiple wars, but there is something new about this open embrace, and it does, as a student of history, echo, I think, the kind of sentiments, the irrationality, the war fever that we saw in the world wars. I do think you have to go back that far. And so this is part of a much wider picture that is shifting the tectonic plates of the world. We're seeing just open justification of increased armaments budgets. They no longer have to really even mount an argument for why there should be increased military spending, because now they just have to say, well, look at Ukraine. Now, in terms of the hypocrisy element here, that's probably subject to another interview because it would take too long, but it's something that's been brought up on social media by good leftists, the hypocrisy of the American and Australian stance. And I think it's the hypocrisy is almost too obvious to mention. We can talk about Australia's involvement, support for the invasion of Iraq, which just for by one example, if you look at the invasion of Fallujah, thousands of civilians dead, white phosphorus, depleted uranium, American Australia's support for the siege of Yemen, which has led to thousands of civilian deaths, including children, Israel's assaults on Palestine, supporting Ethiopia against the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, that's led to human rights abuses, thousands dead.
And support for the Saudi war on Yemen.
On Yemen, absolutely. So I think it's so obvious that it goes without saying, but the kind of a sick spectacle we're seeing of countries like Australia and the UK and the US once again, for the umpteenth time, pretending to stand for democracy and independence and against dictatorship, when these are countries that support dictatorship, bloodshed, war, genocide throughout the world as a matter of course in order to protect their business interests and their investments. And that's, you don't have to believe me on that front. It doesn't take a great deal of research to see that the Australian government, the American government, are government soaked in blood with no principle. So any principles they're claiming to defend around democracy, human rights, there's no credibility at all in the stances they take. And it's important to mention that for a variety of reasons, one of which is we shouldn't be supporting Australia fueling the war. I've said that before and I'll say it again. And I think it's worth mentioning again and again because, unfortunately, we've seen some elements of the left take a position that will somehow, Russia is the big baddie here. And we should fall in line behind our governments. And I think that's a really dangerous way of thinking because in a domestic way, that takes away from health budgets, education budgets. It gives credibility as well. This is important in the context. It gives credibility to the Morrison government in the context of an election campaign just around the corner. So that would be a fatal mistake for people on the left to somehow fall in line behind Morrison, in supporting the Ukrainian government.
I mean, the Liberals were using military and defence as a election tactic before this invasion even began.
That's right, and this is where again the wider context comes into play. We've seen Solomon Islands in the news in recent days with talk of a deal, which is Solomon Islands government has since reneged on under Australian pressure to host a Chinese naval base. So you can see, that's just one of many examples we could point to where all of these things are connected.
In some of the conservative media in Australia, I heard things like we should be willing to invade the Solomon Islands.
Yeah. Well, and that's an example, Joni, of what I'm talking about, that open embrace of militarism and that open embrace of actually organised state violence as a solution to the political problems the coalition government faces. And for that to be said in public by a senior commentator is, I think, significant. And you can rest assured there'd be elements inside the Morrison government that would quietly support it, though they may not be willing to publicly state that declaration themselves. So this is the kind of world that we're entering. This is the historical era we're entering where war is now seen again as a legitimate means of solving political problems and achieving economic political objectives. And it doesn't take a political genius to recognise that, sort of behind the curtain, if you like, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and that shifting of the tectonic plates is China. China is the number one enemy of the West, and really, ultimately, that's what this conflict is about. Russia is a junior partner. And we were seeing alliances solidifying on the other side, by the way. So Putin went to New Delhi. He had a meeting with Modi. Modi has reassured Russia of support. And it's worth briefly saying that the sanctions, even Western commentators are admitting the sanctions not hitting as hard on Russia as they might otherwise have done. And that's lots of complex reasons. One is that a lot of Russia's foreign reserves are held in renminbi rather than US dollars. So what they're developing is a kind of a closed financial network, relying on China, relying on India, bolstering some of its trading relationships with those countries within that orbit, with African nations, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we're seeing almost a splitting of the global financial system as well. That's one of the things that's going on. So, for instance, Russia is now demanding that its gas be purchased in rubles. It's putting Germany and Italy over Putin's knee and saying, well, Germany and Italy, you rely on our gas. Guess what? You're going to have to pay for it in rubles to help bolster our economy. So Russia is fighting back on the economic front and is not suffering as badly as people might have thought. But guess who is suffering? Guess who is suffering? It's the ordinary Russian people, just as
absolutely
the Ukrainians suffering under the hammer, of this horrific invasion.
Right, Alex, we'll wrap it up there. There's a lot more we could talk about, but we'll have you on again. And I believe you'll be in to host with us next week.
Looking forward to it, Joni. Yep. And as you say, there's much more to be said. And I will just say briefly, why are we concentrating on this so much? It's because it's of global significance.
Absolutely.
We care as much about the victims of imperialism in every other part of the world, but there are reasons why we're focusing on this conflict so much, because it has such huge repercussions, throughout the world and for the kind of world that we're entering into.
The multipolar world, as we keep hearing from a variety of commentators.
Indeed, yeah, absolutely, Johnny. And it's been a pleasure, and I'll see you in the studio next week.
Absolutely. Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to the Indie Media Podcast, first broadcast on RTRFM 92.1.
Greenpeace activists blocked the transfer of 100,000 tonnes of Russian oil between two supertankers off of Denmark's northern coast on Thursday. Activists in kayaks joined swimmers in heavy protective gear who braved frigid temperatures to place their bodies in between the two giant ships in an act of non-violent civil disobedience. And Pakistan is in constitutional crisis as its president has dissolved the National Assembly on the advice of Prime Minister Imran Khan. The deputy speaker declared the motion of declared the motion for a no-confidence vote against Khan unconstitutional and part of a plot by foreign powers to interfere in Pakistan's democracy. No prime minister in Pakistan's history has completed the full 5-year term. A United Nations donors conference for Afghanistan raised barely half of its $4.4 billion goal on Thursday as Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that the nation's already dire humanitarian situation is worsening. It's the second UN donors conference to come up short of its goal this month. Aid groups continue to demand the Biden administration and European leaders release frozen reserves from Afghanistan's central bank, warning that without funds, Afghanistan faces a total collapse. In the US, Amazon warehouse workers in Staten Island, New York, may be close to forming a union as early results of the anticipated election Thursday show union efforts ahead of hundreds of votes. Ballot counting at the Staten Island facility continues today. Meanwhile, a redo of the union election led by Amazon warehouse workers in Bessemer, Alabama, is still too close to call. There are over 400 challenged votes that could impact the outcome of that election in the coming days. The second vote in Alabama comes after the National Labor Relations Board found Amazon unlawfully interfered in the first election last year. Back in Australia, and the Murdoch Empire has borrowed $100 million from the state-owned Bank of China. Despite the company's media operations slamming Xi Jinping's regime, the Murdochs accepted the multi-million dollar loan from the government-run bank. The Bank of China is the second biggest player in the 13-bank News Corp syndicate after Bank of America, which is contributing $117 million. And Craig Kelly, lead candidate for the United Australia Party, is attempting to shirk responsibility for the comments of Mark McMurtry, a known sovereign citizen and conspiracy theorist, after anti-Semitic comments he made at a UAP rally in front of Parliament House. And those are the Indie Media headlines for today. Yeah, but as we always say here on Indie Media, don't hate the media, become the media.
Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?